So I'm here with Glenn Byrne, who's very kindly agreed to record an oral history recording for the Generational Echoes project. It's the 13th of April 2023, and we're very pleased to see you, Glenn. I understand that you have some family heritage in the West Quarter of Exeter. I wonder if you could tell us something about it.
Certainly, yeah. Well, my connection with the West Quarter begins with my great grandparents. They met and married in Exeter in 1885, and at that time they were living in Hawkins Buildings, Haven Road. Now, I don't know if Hawkins Buildings is actually within the West Quarter because it's on the other side of the river. But my great great grandparents had moved from Cholmondeley and Crediton to the St Thomas and Alphington area. And sometime after my great grandparents married in 1885, they moved temporarily away from the West Quarter. They went to, I think, because he was just an agricultural labourer, so it's probably where he could get work, to be honest. But in the 1891 census, they appeared in Drew Stainton. And then they moved back into Exeter up at Summerland Street, which is part of St Sibwell's. They're there in 1901. And then they moved back to the West Quarter. Now, my nan, who brought me up, always told us that she was born in the actual customs house on New Year's Day in 1901, which was probably a sudden delivery, as her birth certificate shows the family living at a place called Tizard's Cottages, which was over by the Welcome Inn. There's a row of cottages by the Welcome Inn on Haven Banks, and Tizard's Cottages are gone though, but they were alongside that existing terrace. The next thing I found out about her is that I've recently come across the school's admissions register for Exeter, which lists all the children that ended up in school. And she started school on the 16th of May, 1906, living at 42 Key Hill. And I believe Key Hill was an extension of West Street that dropped down towards the Custom House, and part of that is still there now. The funny thing about that was my nan always told me that my great grandfather had forgotten to register her birth. She maintained that she was born on the first day of January in 1901, but her birth certificate is dated 1903. And she may, I don't know, she may have been right, because when she's registered as going to school, she's only 3 years old. So that seems, if she was born in 1903. Anyway, they were obviously then living at 42 Key Hill. And then by the next census in 1911, they're all living in 38 West Street. They had seven children. Well, my great grandmother had had seven children, but only five were living, because on the 1911 census, you had to put how many children there'd been. Not sure what happened after that. The story is that my great grandfather used to drink a lot, and either he'd moved out or they'd thrown him out of, but they carried on in some sort of amicable arrangement, living next door to each other. But so by the time of the next census in 1921, I can only find, living in the West Quarter, my great grandfather, who's living still in West Street, but on his own. But as the story went, he's living at the house next door to where they used to live. This must have happened, him moving out must have happened at least 6 years before that, because my two great uncles had gone off to the First World War. And I've got a copy of a letter that my great grandmother wrote to the War Office in London. Quite poignant, really. She's very worried about what had happened to her eldest son. because she hadn't heard from him since he went off to war. And that was probably because, you know, I used to live with him and he couldn't read or write. So probably no communication there. But at that time, she's living in Elm Grove Terrace in Exeter. So she's obviously moved away from West Street. The youngest of her children, my nan, was by now living up in London. The two sons were away at the war. Her eldest daughter had met somebody and they went off to Canada. So at that point, they've kind of moved away from the West Quarter and left my great-grandfather living there. Now, the next thing that happens is in 1923, he drowns in the River Exe. Now, my nan never really wanted to talk about him much, and it seemed like he was a sort of black sheep of the family because he apparently used to like a drink, cider. And whenever I asked what happened to him, she said, oh, well, he drowned in the River Exe. And I got the impression perhaps that he was drunk and that he'd fallen in and he only had one arm, she said. So I had visions of this poor bloke, you know, not swimming around in circles until he drowned, which was a bit sad. But it wasn't until years later when I was trying to do some research on my family history that I found the story of what had actually happened to him. Now, there was a report in the paper on Good Friday in 1923 that a body had been found in a really badly decomposed state down in near Turf Locks by some fishermen. And he was subsequently identified mainly because of what he was wearing and what he had in his pocket. And they described in the paper in detail. I mean, he had obviously he didn't have a lot of money because he had tuppence halfpenny in his pocket, in a purse in his pocket. They talked about how many teeth he had and what height he was and what, you know, exactly what he was wearing. And anyway, by the following week, they'd worked out who he was. And the only witness at the inquest was the landlord of the Royal Oak, where he did used to drink in Alphington Street. That pub's now gone. And the landlord said that he came in and was clearly unwell. And he sat by the fire, shivering, and didn't have any drink at all. And the landlord said to him, I think you ought to go home and go to bed. And he said, well, I am going to, but I'm going to visit my employer who lives on, he lived down on the riverbank. And the inquest decided that through his bad sight, he'd accidentally been confused by the lights on the water and walked into the river, which was in flood and was swept away. In the meantime, my nan had gone to India in about 1920. And sorry, just after 1920. In the 1921 census, she appears working for what was obviously quite a rich family in Kensington in London, who had a very large house. And she went out to India as nanny for the daughter with that family. Now, she met and married my grandfather in Italy, and I think they had quite a good lifestyle because he was personal hairdresser to the commander-in-chief of the, you know, the English commander-in-chief in Delhi. But he died suddenly while he was out there. And my nan had to return home with the two children, my mother and my uncle, who had been born in India. So I always think it must have been very difficult because they came back to live in the West Quarter. She'd had to pawn, or I think her mother pawned all her jewellery when she came back. I've got a paper cut in that says about how she was presented with a diamond tiara at her wedding, and all that was pawned, and they came back to live in what was poverty, really, at the bottom of Key Lane then. They lived above a shop. I've been able to find that on a map, and it was at the bottom of Key Lane, And there was a small lane that went off behind what I think is now a sort of nightclub that border that is opposite the customs house. And there was a place called Horse Lane there, and they lived on above this shop on the corner there. And I do remember my uncle telling me, as he was a boy then, that there used to be a 40s ice cream cart that positioned itself at the bottom of Key Lane and sold ice cream to the kids down there. And he tells me about another Italian ice cream family in Exeter that I think was called Casalucci or something like that. And apparently one day Casalucci's ice cream cart turned up at the same time as 40s, and it resulted in quite a punch up. So it was Exeter's own kind of version of ice cream wars, I suppose. The only other little snippets I've got really of their time in the West Quarter is I remember my mother telling me about farthing breakfasts that were served in the West Quarter. Now, I don't know whether they went there regularly, but I imagine they were poor enough to. Another connection I've got with that area is what used to be known as St. John's Congregational Church. Now, it was in a place called Tabernacle Court, which was at the bottom of Coombe Street. And my godmother, who was called Olive Soundways, for many years, from before the war, up until the 1950s when I was on the scene, used to be the caretaker there. I think it had quite a history, that particular church. And it's still there now. I believe it's now called the Riverside Baptist Church. But in the 1950s, as a when I lived with my nan as a young boy, I used to go to church occasionally with them on a Sunday night. So it would be my nan and my aunt. We would get the bus from Burnt House Lane to South Street, where the site of the South Gate is now, and walk down Key Lane. And I seem to remember going down like an alley and ending up back in Coombe Street and going to the church there. And I do remember they always used to take mint imperials and a chocolate sweet called raspberry ruffles that I really liked. I think that was to keep me quiet during the service. I've got some photos that I sent into Exeter Memories, which are on the site now, of the interior of the church that I found amongst my nan's belongings after she died. A couple of things I remember about that church. One is going to a service one night and being surprised to find that the preacher was actually my teacher from Bradley Rules School. The other little thing I remember is that there was a wall surrounding the church, and it was topped by pieces of broken glass set in cement, and that I've got distinct memory of that, presumably to stop people climbing over the wall. And as you came out of Tabernacle Court, there was a very old cottage on the left. My nan used to go in there after services to visit an old lady, and I just remember it being very, I suppose, Dickensian, really, very small and pokey. I remember her going in to visit that. We also had relatives that I don't know who they were now. Of course, my mum's gone now. But my mum also used to visit this relative, and they lived right at the bottom of Stepcott Hill. On the right, as you start going up, there's a tiny little alley, and they lived off that. I think I only went in the house once, but I remember that being, you know, again, very, very small and pokey by our kind of standards now. And the other thing I remember about Stepcott Hill was my nan used to know a bloke at the top of Stepcott Hill who didn't have a nose. Something had happened in the war, I think, and he had a peculiar plastic nose. Oh, it looked like plastic. And I was always told off for staring at him when I did see him. But Of course, another thing a lot of people remember that I've got fond memories of is crossing the river on Butts Ferry at the quay. I think it was either a penny or tuppence at the time. And I remember my nan always used to give me the fare so that I could pass it to the ferryman. Of course, my family moved out of the West Quarter when they cleared it and moved into Burnt House Lane. Both my nan, who I lived with, and my aunt, who had been the caretaker of St. John's Church, she moved one side of Burnt House Lane, my nan moved the other. Now, my nan's cousin lived at the bottom of South Street, which I suppose is on the edge of the West Quarter. And I do remember her telling me, and my mum telling me, that on the night of the Blitz, or one of the raids in the Blitz, this cousin from South Street came out to stop with my nan. She used to come out regularly and play cards with me nan. And I think my nan said, "I think you perhaps ought to stay here tonight." And of course, that night there was a raid. And luckily for my nan's cousin, really, because the following morning she said, "I really can't face going into town to see what's happened to my house." So my nan took my mum and they walked into town from Burnt House Lane. And when they got to South Street, the house had been completely demolished, except for the chimney stack. And what they found amusing in later life was that the stove was still attached to the chimney stack and still had a kettle on it. And my nan didn't want to go back and tell her cousin what had happened, because she thought the shock would be too great. So she walked from South Street through the centre of town, that was obviously in a bad state, right out to Whipton, where the cousin's daughter lived, to ask her to come back to Burnt House Lane with her to tell her mother what had happened. So I often think that was quite a walk for my, and it obviously was, because my mum walked it with her and always said, "Cool, that was, you know, that was a long way out there for that." So they went back to take the bad news back there. That's about all the story I've got, really. You know, obviously this is, as you say, a generational thing, and you know, when you're younger, you don't listen to all the stories, and these are just ones that I've kind of remembered since then. But hopefully that might be of some help and might ring some bells for some people.
It's absolutely wonderful, Glenn. It really does. And I love the way that you tell it almost from a child's eye view as well. That's really a lovely perspective on it.
Yeah.
I've got the part of the focus of the Generational Echoes project is South Street itself. It's kind of like a boundary to the West Quarter, isn't it, really? But do you have recollection of shopping on South Street as a youngster? Or
yeah, I do. I remember my nan used to go, I think there was a shop up near where the Kentucky would now be. There were two shops, I think almost side by side. Now, one was called Home and Colonial, and I can't remember at the moment what the other was. But my strongest memory is of going in there to buy broken biscuits. They had a big tin tub with like a glass bit set into the lid. And you could look into there and see these broken biscuits. And you could buy, I think, like half a pound of broken biscuits. I can't remember a lot else about South Street itself. I remember being shown what I later found out was the Vicar's Choral that had been bombed, but because that's still a ruin now. But I can't remember a lot else, really, to be honest, of South Street.
So would that have been post-war, your memory?
Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't born until 1951.
Oh, right, fair enough.
No, my my mother, I'd live with my nan, and then my mother had managed to get a council house at Beacon Heath. So when I was nine, I moved to live with her and my stepfather at Beacon Heath, and my next brother down. And then two more brothers were born while I was there. So my mum had four of us. And I think I was only about 11 or 12 now, when I used to go into town on a Saturday morning to do shopping for her. And that's when I remember going in and buying these broken biscuits. But I can remember a lot of going shopping in Exeter, but not a lot else in South Street. I can remember butchers in North Street and but
wonderful. So yeah, I mean, and it's such a sensible thing, isn't it, to sell off broken biscuits? Why don't they do it now?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and it's that kind of richness that's absolutely brilliant.
And of course, you would buy tea loose, which is a thing that you don't think of nowadays at all, is it? So it was always buying loose tea in Home and Colonial. I wish I could remember the name of the shop next door, but I can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. And what we'll do is we'll close the recording now, unless there's anything else.
No, I don't think so.
But if you stay with me.